Welcome back, everybody. We continue with our analysis of harmonic oscillators, driven harmonic oscillators, and then we will apply that to the harmonic oscillators that come up in quantum field. We have one little thing to add to our analysis of the previous lecture, which is the energy budget. So, remember, we studied the harmonic oscillator that's driven by an external driving force. And we can consider the case, for example, where the harmonic oscillator is initially in its ground state, then a driving force shakes it, driving force ends, and then the harmonic oscillator is in an excited state. Or is it? You see? Is the harmonic oscillator going to be in an excited state or not? Technically, no. It's still in the old state, right? Because we are working with the Heisenberg picture. The state hasn't changed. The operators have. Let me ask you a related question. Imagine you have a Hamiltonian, and it takes the following form. P squared divided by 2m plus a potential. And that potential has a time dependence in it. Before time t0, potential is not there. And after some time, capital T, the potential again is not there. So you would imagine that the Hamiltonian before the potential was active is the same after as the Hamiltonian after the potential was active. Right? No. See, the reason is that we are here working with the Heisenberg pictures. The operators change over time. All of the non-trivial time evolution is stuck in this, encoded in the operators. And here's an example of this occurring very visibly. So we are considering the energy eigenstates now of a harmonic oscillator before, during, and after a force has acted. Remember, we can write the Hamiltonian in the presence of a driving force f of t, always in this form. Oh, the driving force j of t, sorry. It's omega times a dagger of t, a of t plus, and then a dagger plus a. Remember what a was. A is, at any given point in time, it's the sum of the position operator q and the momentum operator p, with an I in it, right? Whatever the q's and p's are, the a has both of them in it. So the Hamiltonian takes this form in general. Now, before the force acts, that term is absent because J is zero. After the force is done acting, that term is absent, again, because J is zero. But does that mean that the Hamilton operator is the same before the force acts and after the force acts? It doesn't, because we have a time dependence in this. The operators have time dependence. Even though the formula for H is the same, these guys are time dependent. And that means that this guy can be time dependent. And therefore, the Hamiltonian, after the force is done acting, can be different from the Hamiltonian before, even though in both cases that term is absent. Okay? So in particular, I mean, that's exactly what we found. I just hadn't highlighted it in this way. The Hamiltonian before the force has acted is of this form. It's not just of this form. That's exactly what the Hamiltonian is. Before the force acted, the Hamiltonian is omega, or really h bar omega, times a dagger in, a in, plus 1/2. The a's have a time dependence. There's a phase factor. Because we are multiplying a in with a in dagger, those phase factors went away. And if you remember, the Hamiltonian was constant in time before the force was acting. And that was the Hamiltonian. T is smaller 0, that's the Hamiltonian. And then while the force is acting, the Hamiltonian takes a more complicated form that involves this integral, and I will just write something here. It doesn't matter exactly what the Hamiltonian's form was in terms of the exact solution, but it was some sort of known expression while the force was acting in the time interval from 0 to capital T. And then, after the force was done acting, The Hamiltonian again took a simple form. It was h bar omega, a dagger out, a out plus 1/2. And a out is not the same as a in. So therefore, the Hamiltonian before the force acted is not the same as the Hamiltonian after the force acted, even though in both cases that term is absent. But our operators are time dependent now. The only chance to encode that something happened, that the dynamics is in the operators. After all, the state has not changed. The system is still described by the same vector in the Hilbert space as it was before the force acted. So then, what is the relationship between A in and A out? Remember, A in was the linear combination of Q and P at the time t0. And then A out was the linear combination of Q and I times P at the time that the force ended. And we found, we calculated, that A out is A in plus J naught. Technically, plus J naught times the identity operator, because that's an operator, that's got to be an operator too. But as is customary, we omit the identity operator. We omit writing it, it's of course there. And what was the J naught? The J naught is this number here that encapsulates the overall effect that the force had on the system. It's the integral from 0 to t of the force function times this plane wave, and we discussed that we can see the phenomenon of resonance arise in here, because if this frequency is very different from that frequency, then this integral, which is like an inner product between two functions, is going to be small. In fact, it would be zero if that was a plane wave, and that's a plane wave, and we are integrating over the entire time axis. But we are not integrating over the entire time axis. Therefore, even plane waves of different frequencies have some overlap. And therefore, even if you don't drive the harmonic oscillator at its resonance frequency, you can still excite it. And that's an expression of the time frequency uncertainty principle. The longer the time interval is, the more accurately do you have to match the frequency. The shorter the time interval is, the less accurately you're allowed to match the frequency and still have excitation of the harmonic oscillator. Okay, but the point I wanted to make is that the Hamiltonian early is different from the Hamiltonian late. As an operator in Hilbert space, they act differently. So for early times, before the force acted, we had that the Hamiltonian was this expression, and in particular, it was a constant operator. We used the commutation relations between the A in and its adjoint to construct the eigenbasis of this Hamiltonian. And we found that the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian at early times, so subscript t smaller 0 means early times before the force acted, the eigenvectors of this operator are called n in with eigenvalues en in. And we thought it would be a good idea to calculate the eigenvectors of this operator because this is a constant operator as long as the force doesn't act. So also its eigenvalues and its eigenvectors are constant. Whereas for other operators, we can have a time dependence, such as the position and momentum operators will be time dependent even when no force is acting. So therefore also its eigenvectors and in principle also its eigenvalues could change in time. But the Hamiltonian is constant in early times, so we constructed its eigenbasis. The eigenvalues, the energy eigenvalues of the inharmonic oscillators, we calculated to be h bar omega times n plus 1/2. And we calculated what the eigenstates are. The eigenstates can all be expressed in terms of the zero in vector by applying the a dagger in operator n times and then multiplying with this normalization factor. That factor is necessary to make sure that these vectors have length 1. And also without proof, we said that the set of all those vectors, where n runs through all the natural numbers, is a Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space of our harmonic oscillator. Now, later, when the force is done with acting, at T larger capital T, the Hamiltonian has become a different operator in the Hilbert space. It still has the same form, but it's a different operator because the A out is a different operator. And but it's still constant. So then we calculate again what the eigenvectors and eigenvalues are of this Hamiltonian now. Now, given that the commutation relations between A out and A out dagger are again the usual ones, and given that the Hamiltonian has the same structure, we can calculate the eigenbases and the eigenvalues in exactly the same way as we did for the Hamiltonian at early times. And in particular, we start with the unique vector 0 out, which is annihilated by the operator A out, which of course we identify with the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. And then we can define the set of vectors n out the same way that we defined the vectors n in previously. Maybe we start with 0 out, apply a dagger out n times, use the normalization factor, we get the n out vectors. Just remember that just because we calculate them the same way or in a similar way doesn't mean that they're the same vectors. The eigenvalues come out the same. They are, for the out Hamiltonian, the eigenvalues are again h bar omega n plus 1 half, where n runs through all the natural numbers. But the eigenvectors are not the same. They have no reason to be the same because the Hamiltonian later is not the same operator as the Hamiltonian earlier. And again, these eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian span the Hilbert space, form an orthonormal basis. So, I mean, how can you think of this? Why are these operators different? It would seem that, well, they have the same spectrum, the eigenvectors look very similar. How is that not the same operator? As an example, think of the angular momentum Lx operator. Right? It has a certain spectrum, certain eigenvectors. And now think of the angular momentum Ly operator. Same spectrum. Similarly constructed eigenvectors, but they're not the same. Right? So they're unitarily equivalent. There is a unitary transformation between the two. A rotation, actually, that gets you from Lx to Ly. But Lx is not equal to Ly. And so similarly here, the Hamiltonian at early times has a very similar structure to the Hamiltonian at late times. There's still the Lx and the Ly. And again, there is a unitary transformation that maps the one to the other, which in fact must exist because the eigenvalues are the same. Not all operators are related by unitary transformations, only those that have the same spectrum. But you have to do a transformation. These operators are not the same. The time evolution has changed the operator. Basically, it sits in the Hilbert space in a different orientation after a while. So how are these two bases related? The bases of the early Hamiltonian and the eigenbases of the late Hamiltonian. Now, first of all, both of them are perfectly legal bases of the Hilbert space. And that means that every one of those vectors can be written as a linear combination of these vectors and vice versa. So in particular, each basis vector n in is a linear combination of the basis n out and the other way around. And that means that there must exist coefficients, let's call them capital lambda n, which in general can be complex valued, such that we can write the zero in vector as a linear combination of all of the basis vectors of the out Hamiltonian. And vice versa, of course. This is an example of a Bogoliubov transformation. So let's try to calculate these coefficients lambda n. But before we do, let's see what the meaning is of these coefficients. Is it just some irrelevant change of basis? Or could it be that there's some physics in these coefficients? Well, let's remember that the state of the system is frozen in time. The state of the system started out, let's say if we start our harmonic oscillator in the ground state, zero in. So that's the ground state of the early Hamiltonian. So we start in that state. And we call this state of the system gamma. So gamma is equal to zero in. Then while the force is acting and so on, and later on even, that's always going to be the state of the system. It's always going to be this particular Hilbert space vector, the fixed vector in the Hilbert space, because it's the Heisenberg picture that we are working in. Now let's say that we want to measure at a late time after the force is done acting. We want to measure, for example, the energy. So we want to measure the Hamiltonian. But the Hamiltonian at late times is given by h bar omega a out dagger a out plus 1/2. In particular, let's say, I mean, we could just calculate the energy expectation value, for example. So we would just put a zero in on the left and a zero in on the right, and we've got the energy expectation value. But instead, let's ask, what is the probability amplitude for finding a particular energy eigenvalue En? So we are asking now, if we prepared the system in the ground state, so energy 1/2 h bar omega, what's the probability that after the force has acted, we find that the system has energy En? But how do we calculate that? Well, the probability amplitude for finding the state n out at the late time t larger capital T is given by the overlap of the state that the system is in and the state that we are wondering whether the system is in when we measure. And the probability for that transition, the probability if we started in the ground state, finding the nth excited state at the late time after the force has acted, is of course just the modulus squared of that overlap here. So let's calculate that. So the overlap of the state that the system is in and the state that we are looking for and out is the overlap between zero in, because that's the state that we prepared the system in, that's gamma, and n out. But we said that zero in, because it's a vector in the Hilbert space, is a linear combination of the basis vectors, which are the eigenvectors of the out Hamiltonian. So we assume that we know those coefficients for now. Then we can write zero in as the linear combination of all the out basis vectors. And then we have here n out, and here we have m out. These vectors are orthogonal to each other. This is just a bunch of numbers. And therefore, we obtain that this overlap here is just a Kronecker delta, nm. Therefore, the sum goes away, and only one term survives, the one where m is equal to n. And therefore, we have lambda n here. So the coefficients lambda n of a change of basis, these Bogoliubov coefficients of a change of basis, directly give us the probability amplitude for finding the nth energy level if we started out in the ground state. So if the oscillator started in the ground state, then at the late time, the probability for finding the oscillator in the nth excited state is given by the modulus of lambda n squared, because that was the amplitude, that's the probability. Now, what will that correspond to in quantum field theory? In quantum field theory, this will correspond to the probability for finding n particles with a particular momentum k. So we are looking at a particular mode oscillator for momentum k. So we are looking at waves of a particular wavelength k, of a particular wave vector k. And we are asking, if the quantum field was in its vacuum state, no particles, the ground state of all of its harmonic oscillators, then how many particles of this particular momentum, the one whose oscillator we are considering at the moment, how many particles do we have after charges and currents have tried to excite the field. So we are calculating here particle creation through external driving forces, the external driving forces being, for example, currents and charges. If the field in question is, let's say, the electromagnetic field, the charges and currents would be electric charges and currents. Now, how do we calculate lambda n? So far, we just assumed, or we just knew that they exist. We know that they have to exist because there's the in basis, there's the out basis, both are bases. Therefore, each vector of one can be expressed as a linear combination of vectors of the other. So these lambda coefficients must exist. But what are they? Let's do it a mathematician way. We claim it's this, and I will prove it. Okay, so the claim is that the lambda n coefficients, those Bogoliubov coefficients, are up to, there's this exponential here, e to the power minus 1 half, j naught squared, 1 over square root of n factorial, j naught to the power n. Let's prove this. So the claim is that 0 in is a linear combination of the n out basis with these numbers as coefficients. And that means that they go here, because these were the lambda n. So let's see what that means. If that's true, then how likely is it to find a large overlap? How likely is it to find a large excitation? What you see from this is that in principle, let me come back to that a little later. Would be confusing now. Okay, so let's just go through the mathematical proof. The claim is that 0 in is this linear combination of the out vectors. What do we have to check? We have to check that this is really the 0 in vector. But how do we recognize the 0 in vector? We recognize the 0 in vector by its property that it's being annihilated by the a in operator. So what we have to prove is that a in applied to 0 in is 0. I mean, we know that that's true, but we have to check that a in applied to that is 0. And we can use here that a in can be expressed in terms of a out and j naught. You see, if we apply the a in operator on all of that, it's not easy to see what it will do, because the a-in operator doesn't act in an obvious way on the n-out vectors. But we can express the a-in operator in terms of the a-out operator, and we know how the a-out operator acts on these. So let's do this. We write a-in as a-out minus j-naught. So our strategy is to check that a-out minus j-naught acting on this, which is to say acting on that, is 0. So let's check that. So we apply a out minus j naught onto all of this business here, all of this. What do we get? Well, this thing doesn't depend on n. So let's that pull in front. Let's pull that in front. And then we have a out minus j naught here. And then we just carry forward this sum and all of these terms in here, and we do a little bit of a manipulation. The n out can be written, can be expressed in terms of 0 out. Remember, n out is 0 out after you apply a dagger out n times to it. So n out is this expression, except it's not yet normalized. We also have to multiply with this prefactor, if you remember. So this thing is the normalized vector n out. OK, so going from here to here, all we did was that we pulled this factor in front. And we expressed n out as being generated from 0 out. Now we have two of those square root of n factorial factors, and they of course combine to 1 over n factorial. But now look what we have in the series. In the series we have something to the nth power, something to the nth power, and divided by n factorial. In other words, that's an exponential here. So what we get is that a out minus j naught acting on this, of which we have to show that it vanishes, right, is this. And all of that becomes an exponential, namely e to the power j naught a dagger out. Right? Because if you write it as an exponential, you obtain j naught to the power n, a dagger out to the power n divided by n factorial. That's exactly what we have here. Okay, so now right. So we have that the A out is acting on the J naught A dagger out, and we have minus J naught on that. So it's just, that's a trivial carry forward here, just writing out that difference. But now that term here is the product of two operators. There is the A out times e to the power of J naught A dagger out. And whenever we have the product of two operators, such as A times B, we can write this as the commutator plus BA, because the commutator is AB minus BA. So overall, on the right-hand side, we have AB as well. So we do this. Then we obtain that this product, this times that, is equal to the commutator of the two plus the other way around. Well, we have this on the left and that to the right. And this term is just being carried forward here. And you see, this is a nice term because it will be easy, it will be going away right away, because the A out acting on the zero out is annihilating. But then what is this? What is the commutator between A out and e to the power of j naught a dagger out? Are you all familiar with what happens when you take if you take a and then calculate the commutator with some function of a dagger? And let's assume that this is a nice function in the sense that it has a power series expansion that is nicely convergent. Then, can somebody tell me what we get on the right-hand side?
U of A prime.
Yes, you get F prime of A dagger. Okay? Now, why would that be so? It's an easy way to see that. I mean, in the simplest case, let's say F of A dagger is just A dagger. Then what is f prime of it? Just, I mean, the derivative of a constant function is just 1, and you have a dagger is 1, right? But also you can view it this way. What are the commutation relations between d by dx and x? 1, right? Namely, if you calculate d by dx, x, g of x, minus x, d by dx, g of x. This is actually g of x. If you don't believe it, try it. Right? And so what we have is that dx commutator with g of x is actually g prime of x. And here's the same thing. So this is a special case. I leave it to you as an exercise to get familiar with these things. Once in your life, you should do this. So it's just important to know. Okay, so what we're using here is that the commutator between A out and this function of A out dagger is the derivative of that function of A out dagger. And what is that? Well, e to the power of j naught times the variable differentiated just gives you J naught down and then this function again. So that's what we have here. We have a J naught and this function. It's actually the first term, J naught, and then that term. And this J naught term is this one. Right, so that term minus J naught, this exponential, has moved into here, this position. And that commutator became this term. And that term moved here. Okay. So we have to show that this is zero. But it is zero because that term just annihilates the zero out vector. And here we have J naught minus J naught, so that goes away as well. So indeed, that is zero. And what we have therefore shown is that A out minus J naught acting on that expression is zero, which is to say we have shown that if you act with A, if you act with A in onto that expression, it is zero. So we've shown that this is indeed zero in. So we've proven that these are really the Bogogliubov of coefficients of that change of bases. Except for one loophole. We may have gotten an overall constant wrong in this. Because we only showed that A in annihilates this. But if it annihilates this, it also annihilates a million times this. So we haven't checked the normalization yet. So in principle, we still need to check that this vector is zero in the sense that it's normalized. Because zero in is normalized. We haven't checked that yet. But I leave that up to you. You can exercise the methods that we just discussed by proving that. I'll give you a few hints down here on how to do that. All right. So now we've done all this work on the individual harmonic oscillators. It's time we apply that to quantum field. Remember we had this picture of a lake where some wave action was going. And then we said we can put a cork in there, and it will bob up and down. And that will give us an indication of what the waves are. But we can actually also use the cork to make waves. We can put a string on it. We can pull on it. We can drag it through the water, and it will create waves in here. We can also take the cork and just push on it or pull on it, and it will go up and down. And again, it will create waves. And we can also get ourselves a fancy cork. And by fancy cork, I mean the following. Imagine you buy yourself a metal spring. So it's a spiral, right? Metal spring. And then you get a big knife, and you cut the cork into two pieces. It's going to be a really fancy cork. So you have two pieces, upper half and lower half. And let's say now you screw the metal spiral into the lower half of the cork, and on the other side, in the upper half of the cork. Now you have a cork, which is fancy. It can actually oscillate. It has a harmonic oscillator built in it, right? Because the upper part can oscillate against the lower part. It's like a spring-loaded cork. If you put such a spring-loaded cork into the water, it won't do anything. But if you actually do spring-load it, so if you, let's say, press it together and then let go, it will oscillate like this for a little while creating waves in the water. Similarly, if you pull on the thing and it will be extended, you pump energy into it this way, and then you let go, again it will go like this, and it will create waves in the water. All of these things have exact analogs for quantum fields. So in particular, you could take, here's the quantum fields, indicating here typical vacuum fluctuations of it, and what's the cork? Well, the cork could be an electron. You can take an electron, and you can drag it around. You can move it around. If you have moving charges in the electromagnetic vacuum, the moving charges will create electric and magnetic fields. They will excite the electromagnetic field. You can create photons in this way, for example, by having charges going up and down an antenna. What about the fancy cork? What's the analog of a fancy quark for quantum fields?
An atom, a molecule.
An atom, that's right. You take an atom and you put it into the quantum field. If it's in its ground state, it's just going to sit there, just like the fancy quark sitting there, not doing anything. But similar to how you can excite the fancy quark by pulling at it and then letting go, similarly there, you can take the you can take an atom or a molecule and excite it, get it into an excited state, high energy state. And then it will lose its energy and will go to its ground state and get rid of its energy in the form of photons that it will emit. Very similar to the fancy quark. If the fancy quark was made out of ideal material, it has no thermal losses, no friction losses, and you don't put it into a lake, you just let it oscillate on its own, in principle, it would never stop oscillating. It would remain in its excited state. It would remain in its energy eigenstate. Just a harmonic oscillator on its own would go forever. Similarly, when you take a hydrogen atom, as described by the Schrödinger equation, if you put it into its fifth excited state, according to the Schrödinger equation, it's going to stay in its fifth excited state forever. It will not emit photons. The Schrödinger equation doesn't account for that. The fifth excited state is an energy eigenstate. How could it possibly radiate? How could it possibly decay? It's an energy eigenstate, so it's by definition, it's just a constant in time. But we know, of course, that that's not the case. A hydrogen atom in its fifth excited state is not very patient. It will pretty quickly generate photons and fall into its ground state, just like the quark does. If it is excited and you put it into the water, then it will quickly get unexcited and all the energy will have gone into the outgoing propagating waves. So similarly, if you want to understand how an atom or a molecule emits photons, the Schrödinger equation cannot tell you that. Instead, what we have to do is we have to take the Hamiltonian of our atom or molecule, we will have to take the Hamiltonian of our quantum field, and we will have to couple them by writing down the interaction Hamiltonian. And then we will see that what was the fifth eigenstate of the Hamiltonian of our electron, of our hydrogen atom, that fifth eigenstate of the Hamiltonian of the atom is not the fifth eigenstate of the total system. The total system consisting of the hydrogen atom Hamiltonian, the quantum field theoretical Hamiltonian, and the interaction Hamiltonian. If there was no interaction Hamiltonian, sure, it would be an eigenstate. But because there is an interaction Hamiltonian, what we usually think of in the first quantization course on quantum mechanics as the fifth eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, in reality is not the fifth eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. It's not an eigenstate at all. And that is why if you excite an atom, it will actually have a dynamics, namely it will decay. The energy will go into the field. It's because of that interaction. And today and the next lecture, we will study exactly how that works, how an atom or molecule can emit particles while decaying, and vice versa, how they can absorb particles. Because you could put, and in the analogous picture, you could take a fancy quark, not excited, just in its resting position, put it in a lake, and if the lake is busy, if there are lots of waves, those waves will excite our quark. And that will take ever so little energy out of the waves, and the energy will go into the vibrations of the quark. And so similarly, the waves in the quantum field can excite our atom can absorb photons. And the same goes, of course, for molecules and crystals and all of that. All right. So no longer we'll be looking at just single harmonic oscillators. Now we look at the harmonic oscillators in quantum field. And we will always compare with what the single harmonic oscillators are doing, just so that we can transfer what we've seen about harmonic oscillators now to quantum field. So remember, for a quantum field, the Klein-Gordon field in particular, for the Klein-Gordon field in Minkowski space, the Hamiltonian takes this form, 1/2, and then the pi hat squared minus the phi, and then the Laplacian minus m squared phi plus, and here is space for currents and charges. In the case of the electromagnetic field, this would be currents and charges, and here's phi again. So this is the Klein-Gordon field, and that is what is important for cosmology. But for intuition, it might be useful if you think of the Klein-Gordon field in this case as a simplified version, a scalar version of the electromagnetic field. And similarly, the J of x you can think of as currents and charges. So in particular, if, for example, you have a charge that is zooming around in space, and in the process it can, because it's an accelerated charge, it can create electric and magnetic fields, it can create photons, then how would you describe that in such a theory? Well, you write down a J of x and t, which is charge times Dirac delta of, and you put here x minus x tilde of t. So x tilde of t is here the path that your charge takes. But in general, of course, this could be a whole current. That doesn't have to be just one particle. Now, it is convenient, not necessary, but very convenient, to again consider in and out periods. So there will be intervals of time when the action takes place, and there's all that time before when no particular driving takes place, and also after when no particular driving takes place. And then we can again, just like we did earlier, ask, what is the overall impact? What is the Bogoliubov transformation from before to after? So let's consider again a case where the driving forces, which now depend on x as well as t, because in a quantum field we have degrees of freedom sitting at every location x. So you could have a driving force, a time-dependent driving force anywhere. You could have a quark everywhere. It's not just one quark, right? One quark drives one local harmonic oscillator, but you could have quarks everywhere. Charges and currents all over the place. So we have a J of x and t, and we assume that at early times it's vanishing and at late times it's vanishing. It's only non-zero between time 0 and time capital T. That means it suffices to consider the early period and the late period, in which cases both of which cases the driving forces are 0. And then we just relate the two bases to each other. The eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian early and the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian late. Now, in the early and in the late period, the Hamiltonian simplifies because the J term goes away and the Hamiltonian of the Klein-Gordon field is simply given by this, just the free Klein-Gordon field Hamiltonian. And remember, we need to solve the following mathematical problem. Here's the equation of motion for the Klein-Gordon field. Again, because we are working in the early or in the late period, there are no driving forces, so it's the old problem that we already considered. And so we have the Klein-Gordon equation to solve, and we have the commutator relations to solve. We adopt the usual strategy, namely we decouple these differential equations. Remember, the way that it looks here, this is one harmonic oscillator at every point in space. Assuming that is absent, these are uncoupled. If at every point x, we have the acceleration here, because pi is the derivative of phi, time derivative of phi, and then pi dot is the second time derivative of phi. So the acceleration is equal to a constant, or minus a constant, because this all needs to go to the other side, of phi. So it's just a harmonic oscillator whose omega squared is m squared, just a harmonic oscillator at every point in space. But because there's a Laplacian, these harmonic oscillators are coupled. That coupling is important because it means that if you excite a harmonic oscillator here, it will tell its neighbors and they will tell their neighbors, and so we have waves propagating. That's nice, that's realistic, but it's a little tedious mathematically. So we do a Fourier transform. After the Fourier transform, here's the Fourier transform equation, the Laplacian becomes k squared. And then we have, again, a differential equation that is that of a harmonic oscillator, except that now, for every value of k, so for every point in momentum space, this is indeed an independent harmonic oscillator. Because we have that the second derivative is equal to minus times k squared plus m squared. So the frequency of that harmonic oscillator is just square root of k squared plus m squared. And there is no derivative term, so we don't have a coupling between the various modes. And the physics of that is that if you excite a harmonic oscillator of one particular value of k, for example, you shoot a laser beam, and that means you're producing plane waves of a particular direction, a particular wavelength, then that laser beam is not on its own going to change its color. It's just going to be occupying the same mode forever, except that the universe is expanding, and that we will have to look into that. But in Minkowski's space, the modes don't talk to each other. In momentum space, the modes don't talk to each other. The k modes are not coupled to each other, unlike the position modes who are. Okay, so we have to solve the Klein-Gordon equation along with the canonical commutation relations and along with the hermeticity conditions. These are always the three things to solve: equations of motion, canonical commutation relations, and the hermeticity conditions. The solution strategy for this problem is due to Fock. And he said, well, let's just proceed analogously to the driven harmonic oscillator that we've already dealt with at early times. So we introduce, just like we did earlier, and just non-relativistic quantum mechanics of one harmonic oscillator, we introduced a variable a of t that knows about both the position and the momentum. The position is the Hermitian part, the momentum is the anti-Hermitian part, and here in quantum field theory we do the same thing, but for each mode separately. So every mode, for every value of a three-vector k, we have a harmonic oscillator. And each of those harmonic oscillators has an amplitude and a canonically conjugate momentum amplitude. And so we define now an A operator that has as its Hermitian part the amplitude of the field and its anti-Hermitian part has the canonically conjugate. Then in terms of these new variables, we can rewrite, again, our equations of motion and the canonical commutation relations and all of that. In quantum mechanics, we found that the equations of motion for q hat and p hat simply become this one equation of motion for A, namely that A dot is equal to minus I omega A. In quantum field theory, very similar ansatz, we obtain that for every one of those quantum harmonic oscillators, its AK operator obeys this equation of motion, very similar to what we had in quantum mechanics, which already tells us we can basically carry forward everything we did before. We just have to put indices K on the frequency and on the A's. Also, the canonical commutation relations between the Q and the P became, after this definition, these commutation relations for the new variables a of t and a dagger of t. And again, here in quantum field theory, for each mode k, for each three-vector k, we have that the commutation relations between the phi and the pi become these commutation relations between the a and the a dagger. And you see, it's very nice what we get here, because we get that the a k and a dagger k prime have commutation relations here with k minus k prime. If you remember, the phi k and the pi k have non-trivial commutation relations. They have this delta of k plus k prime. And it created some difficulties, but not with the a and a daggers. So that's fine, and everything goes through very nicely the same way that it did with the harmonic oscillators that we considered in the previous lecture. I wanted to highlight that this is the situation before the force is acting. Right? So this is at early times. Omega is constant. Hamiltonian is constant. What was the solution that we found? Well, we found earlier that in the case of quantum mechanics, just one harmonic oscillator, at early times, A of t was simply given by that. I mean, I shouldn't say we found that. We can find it right away, right now, because that's the differential equation. And obviously, its solution is what we have done here, right? So this solves that. And so similarly, in quantum field theory, we have this differential equation for the AK variables, and it is solved by that. Only difference is that we have to do it for every K separately. Oh, and by the way, remember that when we first defined A of t in terms of the position and the momentum operators, we introduced here some arbitrary constants alpha and beta. And then we fixed them by requiring that the canonical commutation relations for A and A dagger come out to have a 1 on the right-hand side, and by requiring that the Hamiltonian becomes as simple as possible, namely that the A dagger squared terms go away and the A squared terms go away. Here we do the same thing. But the coefficients that we get depend on k. So we actually get different coefficients for every mode. We are really using this freedom now very wisely in that we always adapt it in this way. So these coefficients are chosen in such a way that for every k, even though the omega changes, for every k we have the commutation relations are always still this. And also, as we will see in a moment, that the Hamiltonian takes a simple form. As I said, that's a matter of convenience. This is just a convenient definition. There's nothing physical about the A's or the A daggers. It's just a convenient, compressed way of encoding in one variable what would normally be in two variables, in the Q hat and the P hat. But it's super convenient, and you made that choice. Just highlighting that, because as I mentioned earlier, because one of you asked, one person's coherent state is another person's squeeze state. Right? So it's a non-trivial thing. Sometimes in quantum optics, you may want to choose your coefficients differently because it's convenient for other purposes. And then you get A operators whose eigenvectors are not coherent states but squeeze states.
So have we infrared regularized this yet? Or is there a delta?
Yeah, not yet, because it's a Dirac delta. Mm-hmm. That's right. OK. So we solve this as we did before. We define A in to be the A in to be the A operator at time t equals zero when the force starts acting. So this then is the solution for all early times. These are the commutation relations, the quantum field theory, that's the solution, and these are the commutation relations. And that means that since we now have the solution, A of t at early time, we can find out what the Hermitian part of the solution is, what the anti-Hermitian part of the solution is. And that will give us what the q of t and what the p hat of t is. And similarly in quantum field theory. In quantum mechanics, we found that if we take the Hermitian part of A of t, we get q hat of t. And that is this, right? It's the Hermitian part. So this plus its Hermitian conjugate. And the p hat of t would be the anti-Hermitian part of it, just I here and then the difference here. Similarly, in quantum field theory, we can go back to the field. The Hermitian part of this operator is the field, phi hat k of t, and that is this part. And similarly, we would get the pi. And then once we have the phi k of t, we can undo the Fourier transform. So we can write these, we can use the phi k of t Fourier transform to get the phi hat of x and t. So we just multiply with the Fourier factor e to the power I kx and integrate over the d3k, and then we get the x dependence, and so we get the field. So we've actually solved the complete quantum field theory for the early times now. because we have phi hat of x, and its time derivative is phi hat of x, and that's the expression for it. Now, what's the Hilbert space of states? Oh, it happened. Okay, Hilbert space of states. Analogous to the case of quantum mechanics, there is, again, a vector that's annihilated. And in quantum field theory, we want a vector 0 in, which is annihilated by all of these operators, by all of the A in K. So that's the joined ground state of all of those harmonic oscillators for all of the wave vectors K. Then the Hamiltonian at early times, we wrote earlier in this way, but now with the definition of the A in operators, we can write the Hamiltonian also in that way. Remember, as I mentioned, we chose the coefficients in the definition of A in such a way that the commutation relations are simple, but also in such a way that the Hamiltonian comes up simple. But yeah, this should be, if we had a box regularization and the momenta were discrete and the Kronecker deltas would be there instead of the Dirac deltas, we would have here a Kronecker delta, except for some extra Fourier factors because we have put this thing in a box. And that's what we will do now. So we get rid of that infinity because technically this looks like an infinity. It's Dirac delta. It's a three-dimensional Dirac delta at zero, right? Corresponding to a 1/2 h bar omega energy contribution from every one of the mode oscillators. See, every one of the mode oscillators contributes this, contributes a 1/2 h bar omega k. Now, this is a divergence, it's an infinity, but it's what's considered a harmless infinity in quantum field theory. And the reason is that it has to do with the long wavelengths. It has to do with large scales. It has to do with the fact that we haven't put our system into a box yet. If we do put it in a box, whose boundaries could be gazillions of light years away, so it makes physically no difference, then our momenta are no longer a continuum, but instead we have a discrete set of momenta, and then the Dirac delta becomes Kronecker deltas, and we get rid of this divergence here. Instead, we have, and this is the prefactor that I was talking about that we get, we get this prefactor that involves the size of the box, and then the integral over all momenta becomes a sum over all momenta, where these are three-component k vectors that can only take values on a grid. And the energies in the Hamiltonian are for every mode h bar omega k times a dagger in a plus 1/2. So it's just, you know, the usual h bar omega, 1/2 h bar omega ground state energy. Now, that contribution is just 1/2 instead of being 1/2 times an infinity. Or technically, it's 1/2 times L to the power of minus 3/2. But it's still an infinity because we have infinitely many modes. It's a discrete set of k values, but still infinitely many. Now, at this point, we can either say that this is a trivial thing that we can easily get rid of. And let me say that first. Why? Well, what we have here is 1/2 omega k summed up over all k, and that's a bad divergence because the omega k grows with k. So for larger and larger values of k, and the k values go all the way to infinity in principle, and a discrete set, but still go to infinity, and 1/2 omega k, that sums up to an infinity, but it's just a multiple of the identity operator in the Hamiltonian, right? Because these are non-trivial operators, but that's just 1/2 times the identity operator. No matter how much you multiply the identity operator with, it's still the identity operator, therefore commutes with everything. And how do you calculate the time evolution in quantum mechanics? You commute with the Hamiltonian. Now, if the Hamiltonian has a multiple of the identity in it, that will drop out in all equations of motion. In quantum mechanics, you can add to the Hamiltonian any multiple of the identity operator, and it makes no difference for the evolution of any observable. Only difference it makes is that the energy expectation value is shifted by as much. But the dynamics is totally not affected by this. So at one, from this perspective, we might think, okay, we can relax, that's fine. But of course, there is something, right? And that something is that in this course, we are serious about gravity. And gravity cares about energy. So you can't just add a bunch of energy to a system and expect it not to gravitate. Right? So eventually, we'll have to address the question. It will come up over and over again, and we will never be able to solve it. But we have to keep in mind that there is an infinity of energy around just from the ground state energies of all those harmonic oscillators of the field. Nobody knows how to handle that. It's way too much. And just to illustrate how much this is too much, this energy. I mean, of course, it's just infinite, right, if you put it this way. But, well, first level of defense would be this. We could say, wait a moment. How do we know that infinitely large k values make sense? If a k vector is very, very, very large, it means we are talking about wavelengths that are super small. And when these wavelengths become smaller than the Planck length, then surely they make no sense anymore, because quantum gravitational effects should make space-time fluctuate so much that it makes no sense to even speak of plane waves. So, I mean, this argument can be made more accurate than I just made it. One could argue that this sum should be truncated. As soon as the k values become so large that we are talking about wavelengths that are smaller than the Planck length, we should just truncate that sum. And then it's no longer infinite, then we are fine. Trouble is, we are not. Because the energy that's still left over, or the energy density that's still left over, because it's a finite energy in a finite size box that gives you a finite energy density, you can ask, how big is that energy density? Well, first of all, it looks like good news, because it is known that there is a pervasive, everywhere present energy density in the universe, the cosmological constant. We know that because it's accelerating now, the universe. It's not a small effect. 70% of all of the energy that we detect in the universe is of that kind. It's a constant energy density all throughout the universe. And of course, that could be a prime candidate for that, because it's a constant energy density. Depends on nothing else, just 1/2 times this, and you can calculate what the energy density is if you cut off at the Planck length. Now, is it anywhere close to the order of magnitudes that the cosmological constant is? No, not. It's 120 orders of magnitude larger. So now, at that point, you could say, OK, it's just a bad prediction, very, very, very bad prediction. But we can fix this by perhaps cutting off much earlier, not at the Planck length. But let's cut off earlier so that the energy that sums up in this way actually is consistent with observation. But then, you see, we are 120 orders of magnitude away. Which means you'd have to put the cutoff at, like, I don't know, kilometers or something, right? So if, for example, and I did this calculation once, if, for example, you consider the cutoff to be at wavelengths of, let's say, tens of nanometers, tens or 100 nanometers, so no wavelengths shorter than that. We know, of course, that there are wavelengths much shorter than that. At CERN, we measure particles that have wavelengths way shorter than that, because the energies are much higher. But let's just say it's tens or hundreds of nanometers, because that's condensed matter physics. That's chemistry. That's the Casimir effect. The Casimir effect is based on quantum fluctuations of the vacuum. We will address that later in the course. Quantum fluctuations of the vacuum. So the very fluctuations which produce this one half, they happen at 10 or to 100 nanometers. That's where they are measured typically. If you put the cutoff there, the energy density that you have just from large scale waves down to 10 or 100 nanometers is still way bigger than the cosmological constant that we measure. So for some reason, this stuff doesn't seem to gravitate. Big question. If we can solve that by the end of this course, it will be something. Anyway, so okay, so this is called an ultraviolet divergence. It is serious because this is about the short distance physics, and we don't know the short distance physics. Something weird is going on as we go to short distances. Whereas the infrared divergence, we can get rid of by just putting the system into a box that's so large that the boundaries don't affect what we're doing here. Okay, now, after the driving ends, so the antenna, the charges have gone up and down the antenna, for example, and then they're done. So the driving force ends at time t larger capital T. Then remember the A operator now for each mode again is has this time evolution just like we had for the ordinary single harmonic oscillator previously. And we have that the relationship between the out and the in A operators is given by A out is equal to A in plus the J naught. Now there is one J naught for every k, for every mode. So what we have is that for we do a Fourier transform of the field, and we do a Fourier transform of the driving force, the charges and the current. And what we see here is that the Fourier transform of the charges and the currents is driving the Fourier transform of the field. So the k mode is driven by the kth component of the by the k vector Fourier transform of the charges and the current. and again we have this resonance phenomenon. So we have that the J naught is given by this integral here. And again, if we have a match between the driving frequency and the frequency of the oscillator that we are considering here, then we get a strong effect and otherwise not so much. So for example, if we have an antenna and we run the charges up and down at the frequency of the mode that we want to excite, then, well, we will have some excitation there. But again, if you do it for a finite amount of time, we are not going to emit a sharp spectrum. It's going to be a somewhat smeared spectrum because of the time uncertainty principle, because that integral is finite length, the product of plane waves. In a product of plane waves is not going to be orthogonal. Two plane waves are not going to be orthogonal on a finite time interval. Okay, so at late times we have these A out operators, and we can again construct the out basis, the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian, of the out Hamiltonian. And we start out by saying that A out acting on the zero out vector gives us zero. That's the joint eigenvectors of all of the joint eigenvector to eigenvalue z of all of the annihilation of all the A operators there. And we can again calculate what the overlap is between the in vacuum and the out excited states. So these coefficients now depend not only on n, but also on k. So we can now ask, what's the probability that if the quantum field started out in the vacuum, the driving force produced this many particles of that momentum. And that's what this overlap coefficient is going to give us. Okay, remember here was the picture. We had the cork, which could bob up and down there. And we had our sophisticated cork with the spring. And we could also move the cork through the water in order to excite water, in order to excite water waves. And similarly, for waves in a quantum field, we could have a charge, which would be described by J of x and t, which in the case of just one charge would have a Dirac delta in it. But generally, it could be just some currents and charges that are flowing around. And now, we are going to upgrade the charge. So this is our sophisticated quark. If you look closely, you see the spring in here. Okay? So this is the spring. It can go like that. And here is as
one
of.
I would be so impressed that you had actually constructed that quark and photographed it in order to make that slide.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I'm not so sophisticated yet. Okay, and then, as you predicted, here would be the atom now. And of course, atoms don't look like that, but you know, what else could we put? So an atom would play the role of a sophisticated quark because it can be excited, and then when exposed, when it starts interacting, an excited atom interacting with the quantum field can decay, right? You may have wondered, you've probably always heard when you did labs as undergrads, you heard about you excite an atom and then it will decay and emit photons. But there's nothing in the Schrödinger equation that would explain that, right? If you have the fifth eigenstate, it's the fifth eigenstate. It will always stay, it will never decay. What was missing is the coupling of your atom to the quantum field. Because then you have that, as we mentioned earlier, then you have that what is the fifth eigenstate for this system in isolation is not an eigenstate of the total Hamiltonian obtained by adding the Hamiltonian of the atom plus the Hamiltonian of the field plus the interaction Hamiltonian. It's not an eigenstate. That's why it's not going to stay in the fifth, in the fifth excited state of that. Actually, for simplicity, we will simplify the situation a little bit. Because it doesn't really matter that we have whether we use a realistic atom here. It doesn't have to be the hydrogen atom's particular spectrum. It could be any atom, could be any molecule. In fact, the basics of it can be seen already with the quantum system that we will just idealize as having two energy levels. Because the only thing that matters is that there is an energy gap, that there can be an excitation and a de-excitation. So if we just have a system that has two energy levels, that already can describe the emission and the absorption of particles. In practice, if you want to make this realistic, if you want to connect that then, the two-level system, to real physics, to real experimentally checkable stuff, then all you have to do is take, for example, the hydrogen atom, if that's the species you work with, and then you take the two-dimensional Hilbert space that's spanned by two eigenstates. Let's say ground state and first excited state or something like that. I mean, I'm neglecting the spin now. But you take, let's say, the ground state, first excited state, a two-dimensional Hilbert space, and you simply approximate that the transition probability for the ground state to another higher excited state is so low that you can neglect it. And that's actually quite often a good approximation. If you are focusing on a particular interaction of particular light with particular, you can steer the interaction between atoms, molecules, and light by using particular frequencies. You know, if you're far off resonance, you're not likely to make an excitation. So it's actually often a good approximation to deal with just the two energy levels that you're interested in. And then we have just a two-dimensional quantum system. And two-dimensional quantum systems have this nice feature that they are very easy to describe with just the sigma matrices. The sigma matrices and the identity matrix, the 2x2 identity matrix, span the space of all operators in two-dimensional Hilbert space. And so you know, it's easy to have an overview of what can happen in such a system. All right. So we want to do an upgrade from the regular quark to the sophisticated quark, from just having a charge, such as an electron, to having an atom or molecule that can actually have internal excitation. So this was before the upgrade. That's just the Hamiltonian of a quantum field, such as a Klein-Gordon field, with some driving force here, where this was number-valued and classical. Now let's upgrade that. And so now we say that we have the quantum system of the quantum field, and it has its Hamiltonian. But we also have the quantum system of our quark, of our atom molecule. So we have two Hilbert spaces here. And the total Hilbert space is the tensor product of the two of them. So in particular now, we have that the Hamiltonian, the total Hamiltonian, is given by the identity operator on the internal Hilbert space of our atom, tensor the Hamilton operator of the quantum field, plus the interaction Hamiltonian. Because this is an interaction Hamiltonian, right? The charge and the field. So this thing actually acts on two Hilbert spaces now. The J hat of T is an operator that acts on the Hilbert space of the atom. That in the case where we just look at two energy levels, it would be just a 2x2 matrix. And that is the field operator. So mathematically speaking, we have identity tensor the Hamilton, the free Hamiltonian of the field, plus the interaction Hamiltonian, which has one leg in one Hilbert space for the atom, and one leg in the Hilbert space of the field. And then in principle, we could also have another term, which is the free Hamiltonian of just the atom. I should say that we are not quantizing everything about the atom here. We're just quantizing one particular thing about the atom, which is its internal degree of freedom. We are not quantizing where it is. We are not quantizing the orbital degree of freedom. We are still putting here just an x of t. Okay? And that's often a good approximation that you can make. Of course, ultimately, the electron at the atom should be described in a different way. This is an approximation, but an excellent one in many circumstances. The full description of what's going on would be that we write down the Hamiltonian of the quantum field, and then we have to write down the Hamiltonian for the electron field, free electron field, and the Hamiltonian for the quarks that make up the proton, and the Hamiltonian for the gluons that hold the quarks together to form a proton, and then the interaction Hamiltonians between all of them, which involve the strong force and the electromagnetic force. And the whole thing would be very, very long. So after a series of approximation, we arrive at this simplified picture that captures the essence of the light-matter interaction in the case where the matter has a position that we can still describe classically. So we don't have an atom that has that is like in a Schrödinger cat state of being either here or there with a certain probability amplitude. But when we know where the atom is, but the state is fully quantum. So whether it's excited, which excited state or ground state it is, that's quantum. So we are quantizing the inner degrees of freedom of the excitation levels of the hydrogen atom or whatever molecule it is. But we are not quantizing the orbital degrees of freedom. So that is to say the motion of the whole thing. The center of mass is not quantized. It can all be upgraded, but just for the purpose of the interaction of matter with light, basic light-matter interaction, that's a very good approximation. Okay, so the J hat of x and t is given by a delta function that fixes us onto the path of our atom. X tilde of t is the path of the atom. And then q hat of t is an operator that acts on the Hilbert space of the atom. For example, if we are picking out just two energy levels, this q hat operator is just a cute little 2x2 matrix, a linear combination of some sigma matrices. So therefore, what we're dealing with is the Hilbert space of the infinite dimensional Hilbert space of the quantum field theory tensored with two-dimensional Hilbert space of just two energy levels of an atom. That's sufficient to capture the essence of the light-matter interaction. Okay, now in simplified notation, the kind of thing that you will find in textbooks and papers, that structure here, namely that the Hamiltonian is given by an identity operator onto the two-dimensional Hilbert space of the energy levels of the atom, tensor the Hamiltonian of the free field, plus this interaction Hamiltonian with the tensor spelled out. In practice, you will usually see in the literature that this tensor product symbol is omitted, the one is omitted, and that tensor product symbol is omitted. But mathematically, it has to be there. And when you omit these things, then you get this kind of thing. The Hamiltonian is, here you have the Hamiltonian acting on just the quantum field, and then this is an operator that acts on the two-dimensional Hilbert space of the atoms, energy levels, And that's the filter operator again. But what you should see when you look at that is that there has to be a tensor product here. And also, this thing must also act on the Hilbert space of the atom's energy levels. So there must be one tensor that in here as well. OK. So now, our charged systems can act as emitters and as receivers of waves, just like our sophisticated quark. This has led Bill Andrew, famous Canadian physicist who is at UBC, to define what a particle is. Basically, his point is that there is no independent definition of particle. There shouldn't be an independent definition of particle. We shouldn't just think of the notion of particle as being something that's obvious, something that needs no discussion. But instead, we should base the definition of particle on something observable. And so what Andrew says is that a particle should not be defined as the excitations of mode oscillators of a quantum field, as we did earlier, by saying that whenever you increase the excitation of a mode oscillator, then you get then it costs you the amount of energy that it would cost you to produce a particle that has the property of p naught squared minus p vector squared is equal to m squared, which is the relativistic dispersion relation. No, he said, that's no good. In any case, it applies only to plane waves, only to particles that have a momentum, a fixed momentum. No, instead, he said, a particle is what a particle detector detects. And a particle detector is our sophisticated quark. Right? So for example, here we have a quantum field. And we can ask, what are the particles of that quantum field? And then Bill's answer would be, the particles, you have detected the particle of that quantum field if, when you've coupled it to a system such as an atom or a molecule, that system has gotten excited. Mm-hmm. Right? So then that system has gotten excited, it picked up some energy, well, it came from the quantum field. So then you would say, OK, each time that such a detector, and you can think of it as clicking, right? So an atom goes into an excited state. This is then the detection of a particle. This is a practical definition. And it has the advantage that you don't just detect plane waves. You can actually tell where you detected the particle. You have to be careful with this, because if you idealize this too much, and you just assume that this is at a point, that this is a point detector instead of an atom that's really extended, then you run into the uncertainty principle. And then basically what you find is that, yeah, if you know very exactly, very precisely where you detect your particles, then you have no idea what momentum it was in. Yeah, because it couples to all modes then. Yeah. OK, so we will sometimes retreat to that definition of what a particle is. We will need to do this. Because we will deal with quantum field theory in the circumstances of accelerations and curvature, where this matters. In ordinary particle physics, as it is done at CERN, for example, this doesn't matter because, as we discussed, the scales are such that the interactions happen in a tiny, tiny volume. But the production of the particles happens on the length scales of kilometers, and the detection happens at the length scale of meters. The detectors are meters away from the collision zone. And the production of the particles is, of course, in this huge accelerator that rings. So when those particles come in, they're basically plane waves, as far as the tiny little volume is concerned. And when they go out, when they arrive in the detectors, they also basically arrive as plane waves. So you can go by the definition that we adopted earlier in the course. But then when we discuss particles in curved spacetimes, that just can't be maintained. But this can always be done. We can always put atoms and molecules into a quantum field and see, will they get excited? And of course, vice versa, they can also emit particles then. In other words, photons can serve as detectors of electrons, electrons can serve as detectors of photons, and so on. I shouldn't say electrons, I mean it's like atoms. And if you want to do the analog, if you want to, for example, detect electrons using photons, you have to localize them. But how? The original idea of Andrew was to consider photons in a cavity. So imagine you have a cavity, you have two mirrors, and then between those two mirrors, let's assume they are perfect, light could bounce. And then if an electron passes through, it can actually excite the mode oscillators in there. So in this case, you're detecting the presence of an electron by the fact that it can create photons as it goes through a cavity. So it goes both ways. You can use electrons and protons and generally charges to detect photons, but you can also use photons to detect charges. Okay. Now, there is an effect called the Andrew effect, and it works like this. Imagine you have a quantum field, and you have an atom, and let's say that this atom is in its ground state. Now we accelerate that atom. And what that does is it will actually excite the atom. There's a finite probability for the atom to be excited when it is accelerated in a quantum field, even if that quantum field is in a vacuum state. But you see what that means? It means that if the field is in a vacuum state for everybody else, somebody who is accelerated will say, no, 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 what do you mean vacuum state? I'm detecting particles here. Because according to the definition of Andrew, a particle is what a particle detector detects. So if it is true, as we will show in next lecture, that an accelerated detector will detect particles, will get excited, even in the vacuum of the field, then it means that an accelerated detector does not agree that a field is in a vacuum state when inertial detectors will say that it is in a vacuum state. And that should give us a hint, because by the equivalence principle, accelerations and curvature are very much related. Gravity are very much related. So therefore, if acceleration can produce particles, maybe curvature can too. We will get to that. So this is the Andrew effect, and this is, I think, as far as we got today. It is. Yeah, so next time we will do the Andrew effect. And we will do general interactions between matter and light. You just have to do that in complete generality, and then the Andrew effect will pop out as a special case. Okay, any questions? Yeah?
I must have read this description of the Andrew effect. So if this atom is accelerated and excited in the field, would an inertial detector not be able to detect those excitations in the field?
Yes, so actually I can already demystify the Andrew effect because you asked that question. So it looks a little mysterious. How come that an accelerated observer, such as an accelerated molecule, will see particles where others don't? Well, you see, the reason is this. The atom must contain charges. I mean, we know it contains electrons and protons, right? And so it has an interaction Hamiltonian with the field. Now, when we take protons and electrons and accelerate them, you would expect that they create electromagnetic waves. And they do that. Right? So you take this atom, the total thing is neutral, but it consists of protons and electrons. So these charges will create electromagnetic waves. Other wavelengths are a little shorter than the size of that. Because from the point of view of large wavelengths, it's neutral, but not from the point of view of short wavelengths. So if you take an atom and you accelerate it, then because there are charges in there, these charges will rub up against the electromagnetic field and excite it. But then the quantum analog of Newton's third law kicks in. Here's the quantum system. There's a quantum system. This one acts on that one and excites it. Because this thing is accelerated, it will excite electromagnetic waves.
But with the same interaction Hamiltonian, that the atom is able to excite the electromagnetic field is able to excite the atom. It just goes both ways. You can't have an interaction Hamiltonian that allows one system to affect the other without the other being able to affect the first. And that's what's going on here. So basically, because this thing creates excitations in the field, the interaction Hamiltonian is important, and therefore the field will also create excitations in here. So ultimately, it's not some sort of miracle that, you know, you accelerate it and then particles come from nowhere, some fairies sprinkle them or something. It's not exactly like that. It's just that the interaction Hamiltonian works both ways. And what is a challenge is that we don't understand yet what the analog explanation is for the Hawking effect. It's not clear whether it has an analog explanation. Hawking effect relies on the existence of a horizon. The Under effect does not. If a particle such as an atom is accelerated uniformly, which means forever at the same rate, then the particle has a horizon, and you can capture the Under effect, and is of the form that our particle, our uniformly accelerated particle, sees a heat bath. It sees particles created as if there was a certain ambient temperature. And it matches what you would expect from the Hawking effect. If you set the acceleration equal to, you know, the acceleration you would expect in a black hole. But the Under effect, as we just discussed, is not tied to the existence of a horizon. Even if the acceleration is just temporary, our atom might get excited. And so it's not clear how far the equivalence principle carries the Under effect over to the Hawking effect. Clearly, there is a close connection, but it's not clear exactly how far it goes. In the case of the Hawking effect, there is, of course, this big question whether information that falls into the black hole ever comes out again, whether we have unitarity of the time evolution. If not, it means that nature can erase information, truly erase information. I mean, so far it looks like when you burn a book, you're not erasing the information, because the time evolution could run backwards in principle. It's a unitary time evolution. It's like a puzzle that has been destroyed into tiny, tiny pieces, but you could put it back together again. But not if the time evolution is not unitary, which might be the case in black holes. And for the case of the Under effect, you can ask a similar question. You see, in the case of the Hawking effect, if you throw something in there, what happens is that the mass of the black hole changes, and that changes the temperature of the black hole. And while the temperature of the black hole changes, it's not thermal, actually. So information can be transmitted in this way. Similarly, you can ask, if you accelerate an atom on a certain path, then it will create a pattern of excitation, and it will create radiation similar to how you modulate Hawking radiation when you throw stuff in there. Here, you don't throw stuff, but instead you move the particle around on a trajectory, and you can ask whether the excitation pattern in the molecule and the radiation created in the field together contain enough information to recreate the trajectory of the particle, the trajectory being analogous to what you throw into a black hole. Because what you throw into a black hole determines how the mass is changing, and here the trajectory determines how the acceleration is changing. And just recently, in a paper last year, a student and I showed that you can do it. And you can reconstruct the trajectory from the radiation emitted and from the excitation pattern. But because the equivalence principle doesn't take us directly to the Hawking case, we cannot really make a good case that this proves anything like unitarity for the Hawking effect. But if for the under effect, yeah. So it's all encoded. The trajectory is encoded in the Manish. But I'm saying this too early. We'll do it next time on Shabbat. Okay. Any further questions? If not, I'm going to ask you again.